Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is, well, pretty specific. We're gearing up for an exam, focusing on monetary economics, EC3T115 level stuff.
That's right.
We're diving deep into money, inflation, and welfare. Forget the basics. This is about the complex theories and evidence you'll need.
Exactly. We're aiming for that university-level understanding. We'll be looking at the tools for analyzing modern monetary policy. You know, the new Keynesian models where things like long-run neutrality might break down, and the real costs of inflation.
Okay, so here's the plan. Five core areas. First up, that crucial link between real and nominal interest rates. Why it holds, why it has to hold for policy to work.
Mm-hmm. Critical stuff.
Second, we'll get into the long run. Neutrality, sure, but really digging into super neutrality, defining it, and importantly, challenging it.
When does it actually fail in the real world? Yeah.
Third, welfare. What's the optimal policy? And how do we even quantify the damage inflation does? We'll touch on that tricky time inconsistency problem, too.
The Barrow-Gordon model, yes. Yeah. Always a favorite.
Fourth, we'll look at inflation from a different angle, as a government revenue source. Seigniorage, the inflation tax.
A fiscal tool, essentially.
And finally, the extreme end, hyperinflation. How does it happen? Why is it so destructive? Okay, let's get started. Right, so modern macro models, like the ISPCMR framework everyone uses, central banks, they need a lever to pull, right?
Absolutely. And the main one, the one they can actually control pretty directly, is the nominal interest rate, let's call it for now.
Usually that's some kind of overnight rate, the rate banks lend reserves to each other.
That's typically it, yeah. And the central bank influences this by managing the supply of high-powered money bank reserves. They adjust the supply to hit their target for that nominal rate.
Okay, so $20 is the instrument. But that's not the end goal, is it? They're not just trying to set a nominal number for its own sake.
No, not at all. The real target, the variable that actually influences economic decisions, investment, spending, is the real interest rate.
But that's the true cost of borrowing, adjusted for inflation.
Precisely. The real rate is what feeds into the IS curve, affecting aggregate demand. High real rates discourage borrowing and spending. Low real rates encourage it. That's the channel they're working through.
So we have the tool dealer and the target variable, R2-dealers.
Mm-hmm.
How does the central bank manage the connection between them, especially when inflation is bouncing around?
That's where the policy rule comes in. Often conceptualized as a Taylor rule or a variation of it, we can write a general form for this reaction function.
Okay, lay it out for us.
It would look something like HRT plus GYTY plus 1 plus HY. Let's break that down a bit.
Right. So the first part, RH pi, that looks like it sets the long run anchor based on the target real rate, $2, and the inflation target, exactly.
That pins down the baseline. Then you have the term DI2. That's the central bank reacting to the output gap, trying to stabilize the economy around its potential.
Makes sense. Keep output close to potential.
And then the crucial bit for this discussion, the third term, $1 plus HPIT. This shows how the nominal rate relate responds to current inflation, dollar.
Ah, okay. So this term, $1 plus HPIT, directly governs that link between nominal and real rates we were talking about.
That's the heart of it. Remember the basic Fisher equation, approximately R cubed to a pot, the whole question of whether the central bank can actually control the real rate and stabilize the economy boils down to the size of that coefficient, $1 plus HR.
And there's a critical threshold here, right? This is the stability criterion.
Yes, precisely. For the economic system to be stable, for monetary policy to actually work in controlling inflation, that coefficient $1 plus HDollar must be greater than 1.
Greater than 1. So if inflation goes up by 1%, the central bank has to raise the nominal rate by more than 1%. Why is that so vital?
Think about what happens to the real rate, R-dollar. If inflation PIT increases by 1% and the central bank raises the nominal rate travel by, say, 1.2%, so 1 plus H equals $1.2%, which is greater than 1, what's the change in the real rate?
Let's see. Tory calls R-KIPIT. So the change is 1 bar out 2%, 1 per equals 0.2%. The real rate goes up.
Exactly. And that's the key. A higher real interest rate makes borrowing more expensive, cools down investment and consumption, the IS curve shifts left, and that reduces aggregate demand, pushing back against the initial rise in inflation. The policy stabilizes things.
Okay, I see. It leans against the wind. So what happens if they don't? If $1 plus HU dollars is less than 1, say they only raise $3 by 0.8% when inflation rises 1%.
Well, that's where things go badly wrong. If trial goes up by 0.8% and TWERA goes up by 1%, the real rate actually falls by 0.2%.
It falls. even though they raised the nominal rate.
Yes, because they didn't raise it enough to overcome the rise in inflation. And a falling real interest rate does the opposite of what you want. It stimulates borrowing, investment, and spending. It adds fuel to the fire.
So aggregate demand increases, pushing inflation up even more.
Precisely, which then requires another nominal rate response. But if they still react with $1 plus H11, the real rate falls again, and you get this explosive, destabilizing spiral of ever-increasing inflation. The central bank has lost control.
And this isn't just abstract theory, right? There's historical evidence for this kind of mistake. I remember reading about the U.S. in the 60s and 70s.
Absolutely. The work by Clarida, Gulley, and Gertler famously showed that U.S. monetary policy, particularly in the pre-Volcker era, roughly 1960 to 1979, often violated the stability condition.
They didn't raise rates aggressively enough.
Often, yes. They tended to accommodate expected inflation increases. They let the nominal rate drift up, but frequently not enough to push the real rate up significantly when inflation rose. In effect, $1 plus errors was often hovering around or even below one.
So they were chasing inflation, not getting ahead of it.
You could put it that way. And that policy stance is seen as a major contributing factor to the great inflation of that period. It really took Paul Volcker's dramatic policy shift in 79, where the Fed jacked up nominal rates so high that real rates became sharply positive, to demonstrate a commitment to that stability principle and finally break the back of inflation.
Wow. Okay, so Section 1's takeaway is clear. Controlling the real rate is paramount, and that requires the nominal rate to respond more than proportionally to inflation. It's non-negotiable for stability.
That's the core operational lesson, yes. The real rate is the lever. The nominal rate response is how you ensure it moves the right way.
Okay, so we've covered the short-run dynamics and the stability issue. Let's shift focus to the long run. There's this classical idea of monetary neutrality. What exactly does that mean in, say, the context of these models?
Right. Monetary neutrality in its standard form means that changes in the level of the money supply, or maybe the systematic, predictable part of inflation, don't affect real economic variables in the long run.
Things like output, employment, the real interest rate.
Exactly. Unemployment, for instance, is expected to return to its natural rate, to middle, regardless of the money supply level. A one-time doubling of the money stock, according to the quantity theory of money, should eventually just lead to a doubling of the price level. Ever dollars, assuming velocity dollars and real output dollars, are determined by other real factors. Money doesn't create real wealth in the long run.
Okay, that seems fairly standard, but then there's this stronger concept, superneutrality. What's the difference?
Superneutrality is a much tougher condition. It argues that the long-run rate of growth of the money supply also has no effect on any real variable.
So not just the level, but how fast the money supply is growing.
Yes. If superneutrality holds, changing the steady-state money growth rate from, say, 2% per year to 6% per year shouldn't affect long-run real output growth or the long-run real interest rate or real investment levels.
And does it hold? Does the evidence back this up?
Well, this is where things get interesting and where the theory often bumps up against reality. The general consensus from empirical studies is that superneutrality often fails.
It fails? How so?
While the basic neutrality concept seems roughly right in the long run, you can't permanently boost output just by printing money faster. The evidence suggests that a higher rate of money growth, especially when it leads to persistently high inflation, does seem to negatively affect real variables, particularly long-run output growth.
So countries with faster money growth actually tend to have lower real economic growth in the long run. That directly contradicts superneutrality.
It does. Studies looking across countries over long periods find that while the effect might be small, or negligible in low inflation environments, in countries with consistently high rates of monetary expansion and inflation, there's often a negative correlation with real output growth.
Why would that be? What are the mechanisms that cause superneutrality to break down? If the level doesn't matter in the long run, why does the growth rate?
It comes down to the real costs and distortions that sustained inflation, driven by that high money growth, imposes on the economy. These aren't negligible.
Like what specifically?
Well, think about high and volatile inflation. It creates enormous uncertainty. Businesses find it much harder to plan to make long-term investment decisions. Is a price increase for their product a sign of real demand or just general inflation? This signal extraction problem leads to misallocated resources.
Makes sense. It clouds judgment.
Absolutely. And it messes up long-term contracts. Financial planning becomes a nightmare. Investment in long-term projects, the kind that really boost productivity and growth, becomes much riskier. Plus, as we'll discuss later, inflation interacts badly with tax systems, further distorting incentives. All these real frictions mean that a high inflation environment driven by high money growth is simply less efficient. It damages the productive capacity of the economy over time.
So, the process of generating high inflation through rapid money growth has real negative consequences, even if a one-off change in the money level might eventually wash out in terms of real effects.
That's a good way to put it. The journey matters, not just the destination, especially if the journey involves constantly accelerating prices.
How does this connect to ideas like rational expectations? I remember models by Fisher or Taylor suggesting policy ineffectiveness.
Right. Rational expectations, RE models, particularly those with sticky prices, actually reinforce the idea of long-run neutrality for systematic policy. The core idea in these models is that people understand the policymakers' incentives and the structure of the economy.
So they anticipate predictable policy moves.
Exactly. In an RE world with sticky prices, output, HE dollars only deviates from its natural or market clearing level if something unexpected happens, an unanticipated aggregate demand shock, or crucially, a monetary policy surprise.
A surprise, like the central bank suddenly printing more money than anyone expected.
Yes. If the actual money supply, MPIAT, turns out to be different from what people expected based on information available at time T to dollar, denoted ET fund emulator, then you can get a temporary real effect. Well, if there's a positive monetary surprise, AMATI UT1 INTOR, aggregate demand is unexpectedly high. Firms see this increased demand. Because prices are sticky in the short run, maybe due to contracts, they meet this demand by producing more. So output temporarily rises above dollars.
But only if it's a surprise. What if the central bank tries to engineer these surprises systematically?
That's the catch. Under rational expectations, they can't. As soon as the private sector figures out a central bank's strategy or rule for creating surprises, that strategy becomes anticipated. It gets built into ET1 and ET.
And the surprise element vanishes.
Precisely. The systematic part of monetary policy becomes fully expected and gets incorporated into wage and price setting. The result, output goes back to the natural rate. Adder dollars, but potentially at a higher average rate of inflation if the central bank was systematically trying to stimulate. Any attempt to exploit a short-run trade-off is ultimately futile and just leads to more inflation.
So RE reinforces that systematic, predictable policy is neutral in the long run for real output, even if unpredictable shocks or surprises can have temporary effects.
That's the key insight. It highlights the limits of what systematic monetary policy can achieve in terms of real variables, which leads us naturally into thinking about what policy should aim for to maximize welfare.
Okay, so if systematic policy can't permanently boost output, what is the goal? In these standard ISPCMR models, central banks are usually assumed to want to minimize a loss function. What does that actually mean for policy targets?
Right, minimizing loss is equivalent to maximizing social welfare, given the constraints of the economy. In that framework, the ideal point, the bliss point for the central bank, is typically where two things happen simultaneously. The output gap is zero, so Y entire is Y volt dollar, and inflation is right on target, PIT equal 10.
So economy at potential, inflation stable at the desired level.
Exactly. The optimal monetary policy, in theory, involves setting the interest rate rule, like the Taylor rule we discussed, in such a way that it guides the economy towards this point. Graphically, it's where the central bank's indifference curve, showing its preferences over output gaps and inflation deviations, is just tangent to the Phillips curve, showing the available trade-offs.
That sounds like a nice, clean, theoretical solution.
Yeah.
But then we run into the problem of inflationary bias, right? The Borah-Gordon model.
Yes, the classic time inconsistency problem. This really throws a wrench into that simple optimal policy story. It highlights a fundamental tension between what a policymaker announces they will do and what they might be tempted to do later.
Let's unpack that. Where does this temptation come from? Why would a central bank want to deviate from the optimal plan?
The core assumption in Borah-Gordon is that the central bank might actually desire an output level that's above the natural rate. Why? Well, perhaps because the natural rate itself is inefficiently low due to other problems in the economy, things like distortionary taxes, imperfect competition, minimum wages.
So there are existing frictions, and the central bank thinks, if only we could just push output a little higher, closer to the true social optimum.
Exactly. So in their internal calculations, their target output level, Y dollars, might be greater than the natural rate. We often represent this desired positive output gap as K, all dollars.
Okay, so they have this hidden desire for T dollars. How does that lead to inflation bias?
It's about the timing and expectations. Imagine the central bank announces a policy aiming for zero inflation. The private sector, believing this announcement, forms its expectations and sets wages and prices accordingly.
Okay, expectations are locked in.
Now the central bank looks at the situation. Expectations are set at zero. It knows it has this desire to push output up by $2. It sees the short-run Phillips curve trade-off. A little bit of surprise inflation could temporarily boost output towards its desired level $Y. The temptation to cheat on the announced policy is strong.
Because the costs of deviating slightly higher inflation might seem lower than the benefit, getting closer to $Y temporarily.
In that specific moment, yes. But here's the critical part. If policy is set under discretion, meaning the central bank decides policy period by period without being bound by past promises, a rational private sector will anticipate this temptation.
They know the central bank wants to cheat.
They know the incentive structure. So they won't believe the zero inflation announcement. They'll expect the central bank to try and create surprise inflation. What do? They raise their inflation expectations, eat pay before wages and prices are set.
To protect themselves from the expected inflation.
Exactly. They build the expected inflation into their contracts. In the resulting equilibrium, what happens? The central bank, faced with these higher expectations, finds that trying to create further surprise inflation is too costly. So it ends up validating the higher expectations.
So output doesn't actually increase in the long run. It just settles back at the natural rate, E-pace.
Precisely. The attempt to exploit the trade-off is completely neutralized by rational expectations. But the economy gets stuck with a permanently higher rate of inflation. This is the inflationary bias. In simplified versions of the model, this steady state inflation rate under discretion might be something like pi PL equals P22, B and a 1, where POE reflects the strength of the desire for that output gap, TP dollars, and B dollar 1 reflects the aversion to inflation.
So all pain, no gain. Just higher inflation because the central bank couldn't credibly commit.
That's the tragedy of discretion in this model. The welfare maximizing solution, therefore, is pre-commitment. If the central bank can credibly bind itself to a rule like a zero inflation target and convince the private sector it won't deviate, then expectations stay low, and the economy achieves both the natural rate of output and zero inflation. The welfare gain from commitment is simply the elimination of that pointless inflationary bias, $2.
Okay, that makes the case for commitment strategies. Now let's talk about the actual cost of inflation itself, even if it's perfectly anticipated. Everyone knows inflation will be, say, 5%. What's the harm? We hear about textbook costs.
Right. The standard list of costs under fully anticipated inflation usually includes 1, shoe leather costs. Because cash pays zero nominal interest, inflation acts like a tax on holding it. People try to hold less cash, meaning more trips to the bank or more complex cash management, which uses up real resources, time and effort, like wearing out your shoes running to the bank.
Okay. Transactional friction.
2, menu costs. These are the physical costs of changing prices, more often reprinting menus, updating price tags, reprogramming vending machines or websites. Again, real resources are used up just to keep up with rising prices.
Annoying, but maybe small.
And 3, informational costs or relative price variability. In a high inflation environment, it's harder for businesses and consumers to track relative price changes versus just the general drift of the price level. This noise can lead to inefficient decisions.
These are the costs sometimes dismissed as a few insignificant welfare triangles, right? But the source material seems to suggest the real costs are much larger.
Yes, I think that dismissal is often misleading. While those direct transactional costs might seem small in isolation, the really significant welfare costs, even for anticipated inflation, often come from its interaction with the tax system.
How does that work?
Most tax systems are designed in nominal terms. Think about capital gains tax, corporate income tax with depreciation allowances, even personal income tax brackets. They're usually set in currency units not indexed perfectly to inflation.
So inflation messes up the calculations?
Massively. Take capital gains.
Right.
If you buy an asset for 100 pounds and sell it a year later for 110 pounds when inflation was 10%, your nominal gain is 10 pounds, but your real gain is zero. Yet you'll likely pay tax on that 10 pound nominal gain. Inflation creates phantom profits that get taxed.
Ouch. That discourages investment.
Absolutely. Similarly, depreciation allowances for businesses might be based on the historical cost of equipment, not its replacement cost. So inflation erodes the real value of those deductions. Income tax brackets aren't always adjusted quickly, leading to bracket creep, where inflation pushes people into higher tax brackets even if their real income hasn't increased.
So even perfectly anticipated inflation distorts saving, investment, and work decisions because of the non-indexed tax system.
Exactly. It leads to significant resource misallocation across the economy. Capital might flow to less productive uses just because they offer better tax treatment under inflation. These distortions are likely far more costly in terms of overall welfare and long-run growth than just the shoe leather or menu costs alone. The true social cost is substantial.
Okay, we've looked at inflation as mostly a problem, something to be minimized. But governments sometimes seem to use it intentionally. Let's shift perspective and view it as a fiscal tool. What's the difference between seniorage and the inflation tax?
They're closely related but distinct concepts. Seniorage is technically the profit the government makes from its monopoly on issuing currency. It's the difference between the face value of the new money it creates and the usually negligible cost of printing it. It's direct revenue for the government.
So printing a 10-pound note costs pennies. The government gets almost 10 pounds in revenue.
Essentially, yes. Now, the inflation tax is the economic mechanism through which the value of that seniorage is often extracted from the public. When the government prints money and spends it, it increases the money supply. If this leads to inflation, the real value, the purchasing power, of all the existing money held by the public goes down.
Ah, so it's a tax on holding money balances.
Exactly. The government gets resources by printing money, and the public pays for it through the erosion of the real value of their cash holdings. It's like a hidden tax. Unanticipated inflation also acts as a capital levy on holders of government debt issued in nominal terms. It reduces the real value of the government's outstanding liabilities.
What drives a government to rely on this? Why not just raise taxes in the normal way?
The ultimate driver, according to the sources, is almost always persistent budget deficits. When a government consistently spends more than it takes in through conventional taxes, and it can't or won't finance that gap by borrowing domestically or internationally,
it runs out of options.
It effectively runs out of options or finds the remaining options politically impossible. The deficit then has to be financed by creating money. The central bank essentially buys the government's debt, printing new money in the process. This is called monetizing the deficit.
So it's often a last resort, driven by fiscal problems. Are there any perceived merits to using inflation as a revenue source compared to, say, raising income tax?
Well, from a government's perspective, especially in difficult circumstances, there can be some perceived advantages. Generating revenue through seniorage and the inflation tax can be done relatively quickly, often without explicit legislative approval. Unlike changing tax laws.
It's faster and maybe less politically visible.
It can be less transparent, certainly initially. It also avoids the direct administrative hassle and potential economic distortions associated with raising other taxes, like income or sales taxes, which can discourage work or consumption. In theory, the revenue from seniorage could allow the government to keep other distortionary taxes lower than they otherwise would be. And as mentioned, it helps erode the real value of existing nominal government debt.
But surely there are major drawbacks. We talked about the costs of inflation.
Huge drawbacks. The main one relates directly back to the inflation tax base. What is the base for the inflation tax?
The amount of real money people are holding.
Exactly. The real money balances held by the public. What happens to the demand for real money balances when inflation gets high?
People want to hold less of it. Because it's losing value quickly. They shift into goods or foreign currency or other assets.
Precisely. Just as high tax rates on income can discourage work and shrink the income tax base, high rates of inflation cause people to economize on real money balances, shrinking the base for the inflation tax. Keynes noted this substitution effect.
So if the base is shrinking, but the government still needs to finance the same deficit.
They have to increase the rate of the tax, the inflation rate, even further just to get the same amount of real revenue.
Ah, it's like the Laffer curve idea for inflation.
Exactly analogous. There's a certain inflation rate that maximizes the amount of real resources the government can extract through seniorage. If they try to push inflation beyond that rate, the demand for real balances falls off so sharply that total seniorage revenue actually starts to decrease.
So there's a limit to how much you can finance this way, and trying to exceed it makes things worse.
Yes. It requires ever accelerating inflation to extract diminishing returns, and that's often the slippery slope leading towards hyperinflation.
Right. Hyperinflation. The extreme scenario. Usually defined as inflation exceeding, what, 50% per month. Prices essentially exploding.
That's the classic definition from Philip Kagan's work, yes. It represents a complete loss of confidence in the currency and a breakdown of the monetary system.
Now, you'd think, in such chaos, people's behavior regarding money would become totally erratic. But Kagan found something surprising, didn't he?
He did. Counterintuitively, he found that even during the most extreme hyperinflations he studied, the demand for real money balances, while plummeting, remained relatively predictable. It wasn't random.
Predictable? How?
It was primarily driven by one key variable, the expected rate of inflation. That expected inflation rate represents the cost of holding money. As expected inflation soared, people rationally reduced their real money holdings in a way that was quite systematic and well-behaved statistically. They were desperately trying to avoid the inflation tax.
So individuals are acting rationally, trying to protect themselves even as the overall system collapses. How does that collapse actually happen? How does inflation get to 50% a month or more?
It almost always starts, as we discussed, with large, persistent fiscal deficits being financed by money creation. The government is essentially printing money to pay its bills on a massive scale.
Okay, that's the initial spark. What makes it explode?
As inflation rises significantly, institutions and behaviors adapt in ways that feed the fire. First, contract lengths shrink dramatically. Nobody wants to agree on a price or wage in the domestic currency for more than a very short period, maybe days or even hours.
Because the value is changing too fast.
Exactly. Second, and critically, you see widespread currency substitution. People flee the rapidly depreciating domestic currency and start using more stable foreign currencies, like the U.S. dollar, for transactions and as a store of value. This is sometimes called dollarization or euroization.
The near abandonment of the domestic money.
Yes. And what does that do to the government's ability to collect the inflation tax?
It destroys the tax base. If nobody's holding the domestic currency, you can't tax them through inflation.
Precisely. The demand for real domestic money balances collapses. So, to finance the same real deficit, the government has to print money even faster, leading to an even higher rate of inflation. It becomes a vicious cycle.
Are there other factors, like wage setting?
Yes. In many historical cases, particularly in Latin America, systems of wage indexation played a role. Wages might be automatically adjusted for past inflation, but often with a lag.
So wages are always trying to catch up.
Right. And in that situation, the only way for the government or firms to achieve a cut in real wages, which might be needed for adjustment, is to push inflation even higher, faster than the indexation mechanism can keep up. This can create its own explosive dynamic where inflation has to keep accelerating just to maintain a certain level of real economic activity or government finance.
Okay, so it's a fiscal problem triggering monetary chaos, amplified by institutional adaptations. Why is hyperinflation considered so uniquely damaging beyond just the obvious difficulty of using money?
Because it represents a fundamental breakdown of economic institutions and trust. The near abandonment of the domestic currency means the government loses a key financing tool, potentially forcing even harsher fiscal adjustments later. But perhaps more importantly, it leaves long-lasting scars. There's often a hysteresis effect.
Hysteresis? Meaning the effects persist even after the cause is gone.
Exactly. Studies show that even after a hyperinflation is brought under control, usually through drastic reforms, maybe a new currency, the public's willingness to hold the domestic currency remains depressed for a long time. The ratio of money, like M1 to GDP, doesn't fully recover to its pre-crisis levels.
People remain suspicious.
Very suspicious. They've been burned badly. This means that even after stabilization, the government's ability to use seniorage, even at modest levels, is permanently impaired. Financing even a small deficit becomes much more inflationary than it was before the hyperinflation occurred, because the demand for money is just lower.
So it cripples the government's future financing capacity.
Significantly. And it underscores why stabilization attempts that only focus on monetary aspects like freezing the exchange rate or imposing wage and price controls are doomed to fail if the underlying fiscal problem, the persistent budget deficit, isn't decisively addressed. You have to fix the source, not just the symptoms. #outro.
Okay, let's recap this deep dive for the EC3-1-on-15 exam prep. We've covered a lot of ground. We started with that fundamental stability condition, the nominal interest rate needing to rise more than 1 for 1 with inflation to keep the real rate under control and stabilize demand. Absolutely critical.
Couldn't agree more. Get that wrong and policy fails.
Then we looked at the long run. Monetary neutrality, the idea that the money level doesn't affect real variables, eventually seems broadly okay. But super neutrality, the idea that the money growth rate doesn't matter for real variables that largely fails in practice, especially under high inflation, due to real costs and distortions.
Yeah, the evidence points to high inflation hampering long-run growth.
We then got into optimal policy and welfare. The time inconsistency problem, thanks to Barrow and Gordon, shows how discretion can lead to an inefficiently high inflation bias without any real output gains. The solution: credible pre-commitment to a low inflation rule.
Commitment is key to anchoring expectations and achieving better outcomes.
And we saw that the costs of inflation, even anticipated inflation, go way beyond shoe leather and menu costs, especially when you factor in the distortions caused by non-indexed tax systems.
Those tax interactions are a major channel for welfare losses.
Then we flipped the script, viewing inflation as a fiscal tool seniorage revenue from printing money, collected via the inflation tax on money holders. Driven by deficits, limited by the erosion of the real money base at high inflation rates.
A dangerous tool with a clear limit, often leading to
hyperinflation, the ultimate breakdown, fueled by deficits, currency substitution, and sometimes indexation dynamics, leaving lasting scars through hysteresis effects, making future financing much harder.
And emphasizing that fiscal sustainability is the bedrock of monetary stability.
So as you revise all this, really keep that tension between rules, commitment, and discretion at the front of your mind. We saw how discretion, the temptation to deviate after expectations are set, leads straight to that inflationary bias.
Definitely. Now, here's a final thought to chew on as you study. We've seen how commitment strategies aim to eliminate that systematic inflation bias. Historically, things like the classical Gulf standard acted as a kind of external anchor.
Right. It provided a constraint on money creation.
Exactly. It offered a form of credible pre-commitment, keeping long-run inflation expectations remarkably stable for decades, even though it meant giving up domestic monetary autonomy. Now, think about today. Modern central banks operate without that kind of external commodity anchor. They rely on institutional design independence, transparency, clear mandates, maybe inflation targets.
So the question is,
how much institutional machinery, how much carefully designed commitment technology is truly needed today to replicate the kind of deep, long-run credibility that something like the gold standard naturally provided? Can sophisticated institutions truly substitute for a hard external constraint in anchoring inflation expectations over the very long term? That's one of the fundamental ongoing challenges in monetary policy design.